Hello, and welcome to I Am Dad Podcast with your fatherhood authority, Kenneth Braswell. 30 minutes of wisdom, information, resources, and nuggets to help you on your fatherhood journey. Or maybe you're just curious and want to hear some real talk about fatherhood, family, and the minds of men. Well, guess what? We got you too. Sit back, grab your pad and pen, and maybe even bring a little something to sip on. Enjoy 30 straight minutes of fatherhood, family, and fun with the Fatherhood Authority, Kenneth Braswell.
Hello and welcome to I Am Dad Podcast. I am your host, Kenneth Braswell, and thank you for joining us another Sunday morning as we continue to elevate the voices of the responsible fatherhood and manhood field to be able to play a role in integrating who we are as men and who we are as dads and who we are as caretakers to our families and to our children and to our communities. And each week I get to talk to another brilliant mind and talk about the phenomenal work that they're doing in their areas, because what we know is we all can't do this alone. We need to partner with others. We need to hear other ideas. We need to hear and see other philosophies, and we all need to support and celebrate the work that we're trying to do to strengthen family. And as I always say, if you are doing family work and you are not including fathers, then you are not doing family work. And it is okay if you want to work with specific populations and not work with dads. Just don't call yourself family work. Call it what it is. And so our men who are out there playing very significant roles in the lives of their children, don't get confused by what you call yourself and what you actually offer to the community. It's nothing more depressing and dejecting than a dad who is seeking services to walk into an organization who says family services, only to find out that that agency does not provide services for men. And so just be mindful of that when you are naming what you do and projecting your energies into our space. My good friend today, Gary Barker, is the president and CEO of Equimundo Center for Masculinities and Social Justice. This organization was formerly called Promundo US, if you don't remember, and they are a major contributor to the international activism on healthy masculinities and male allyship and gender equity. He is also the co-founder of Men Care, a global campaign in more than 60 countries to promote men's involvement as caretakers. And he is also the co-founder of Men Engage, a global alliance of more than 1,000 NGOs. He is the co-creator of the International Men and Gender Equity Survey, the largest survey of men's attitudes and behaviors related to violence, fatherhood and gender equality. He also leads Equimundo's State of the World Fathers Report, which has become a major advocacy platform for the global care economy. And so he has many, many other accolades around, including doctor. And I didn't know that. And I, you know, now I'm ashamed to address you, not say Dr. Barker. That's, you know, I'm sure you put a lot of work in getting that work and being able to be called doctor. And I want to make sure that we are clear that you have put the academic work in, the work that you're doing through Equimundo. How you doing, Gary?
Hey, I'm doing okay. Thanks for having me, Kenneth.
Oh, no problem. And so, as always, we just start with conversation. And so, because I think that's the best way for us to receive information that connects with our soul. And so we can talk academically and spit research and statistics, numbers, and it will go over people's heads unless they really understand why we are talking about what we're talking about. So as usual, I'm going to start with you like I start with many of my guests, and that is starting with your own daddy story. Tell me a little bit about your daddy story.
Yeah, so I go in two directions with that, whether I talk about my own dad or my, you know, story of being taught to be a father with the birth of my daughter. But I'll start with my daughter because, you know, spend a lot of hours in my day thinking about her. My partner's Brazilian, and we moved to Chicago to work on when I was working on my PhD, which is in child development, how do children grow, thrive, be in the world. Which was a field largely of women and about moms. And my wife and I, far away from family members, caring for, you know, what does it mean to become parents? And very quickly, early on, my wife reminded me, you know, Brazil's got 5 months paid maternal leave.
Wow.
And you brought me to this backwards country where I have zero paid guaranteed leave. not to mention, is it cold? But there's no paid leave. She was our, you know, the main breadwinner of our household at the time. She's a therapist and was working full time. She had some, you know, as we typically call leave in this country, leave is given to you as a health benefit or a disability benefit. And she's like, this gets even worse. You call this, you know, you call motherhood and pregnancy a disability in this country. Like, mm-hmm. Where have you brought me? So I had this amazing challenge of being a stay-at-home part of the time, not every single day, but part of the time, with this belief that I was going to keep working on my PhD and write papers while baby slept. And I had an amazing education in how to realize you are in control of nothing. Stepping into the, you know, the helplessness of, I got to figure this out because I'm learning theoretically about babies. But, you know, this little crying, cooing one in front of me, you know, is like writing a new handbook for me every day. And I did something that we're not very good at as men, but I like reached out to some other men and I said very desperately, I said, help, do any of you guys know what you're doing here? And I brought together a group of fathers, and some of that work, you know, some of those conversations led to some of the things that my organization does all these years later, which is to say, how do we change health systems? How do we create a space where dads are allowed to say, we need help, you know, we need to know how to do this? How do we create the policies around us? Because I think our, you know, our family story of we moved to a city, neither of us had family, was like, man, we're missing our village here. Where is our village to help do this caregiving? And so really that was, you know, I've got an amazing relationship with my daughter these 25 years later. And I'm still, you know, going on about how this country does not yet have paid leave for mothers nationally guaranteed or for fathers. That's one of the motors that drives me. I can remember those cold mornings, those cold sleepless nights, of just how much we all need a huge help to be the, you know, the parents that we want to be. And I just got to spend 2 weeks back, just got to spend 10 days with my daughter. We do kind of a father-daughter trip at least once a year. We were doing hiking in West Texas and just enjoyed, like, it is an amazing gift. So that's one of the reasons I do what I do.
Wow, it's amazing, because on my way back from Kenya, I sat next to a mom and her daughter, and they had just come back from scaling Mount Kilimanjaro.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I was like, what? And they was like, yeah, 8 days. We, you know, climbed all the way up to the top and back down. And I was like, man, that must have been so exhilarating. And she was just talking about, you know, that it's important. Because she asked me what I did, and I told her about my work, and she was just gushing over the fact that, you know, I was talking about dads because her dad was in her life, and her dad and the daughter do the same kind of excursions around the world, primarily for that bonding time. And what she said was, it's very important for parents to achieve large reaching goals together and independently, so that the lesson is in that you can go far. You can go as far as your imagination, you know, can take you. And sometimes the path towards those goals are not easy, both mentally and physically. And I thought that, man, that was such a profound element that I kind of thought about integrating into some of the work that I'm doing with dads, which is try to figure out how to create these activities to fold in this whole notion of bonding and goal setting and the journey and adversity, yeah, and all those kinds of things. So it was just kind of great. So you told me about your fatherhood. So tell me about your dad.
You know, I always love that question. My dad was a social worker. From California, his first caseload was working for the state of California working mostly with migrant family households, most of those Hispanic. His parents were itinerant farm workers as well, moved from Oklahoma during the Dust Bowl to California. So it was kind of, you know, for him, a cause. And it was a mostly female profession. It still is. And he would talk about, you know, kind of his encounters in manhood of men he was trying to reach out to around child support, or around maybe there was an issue of neglect and a report, and whether the child was needed to come into protective custody or not, and just how challenging it was, but also rewarding to talk to men about that. Mm. And I think, and my two siblings are adopted. We had foster children come and stay with us for a month or a few years, all my time growing up. And so for me, this, you know, men in caring, being caring in their daily lives, but being in the caregiving professions is just so normal. It is, you know, it was, I just feel immensely privileged that I could look up and say, that to me is the best of what manhood is. That it's not about, you know, the use of violence or harm, or, and even his idea of protection of kind of, you know, was just the nurturing protection. So I feel tremendously blessed. And, you know, my dad passed away 2 years ago during COVID, not of COVID, but, also just had this silver lining during COVID of getting to be with him, during his last 2 weeks of life, because we were able to work remotely and, you know, just to like honor the trajectory of his life by being there, you know, at the end of his life, not only then, but, it was meaningful to be able to do that.
Wow. It was amazing. When I hear stories like that of things that, you know, tragically happened to people during COVID, that one of the blessings in all of that is that it gave us the ability to be more physically connected to our families. It's kind of odd how that happens, huh? Yeah. Where we thought
it took that to wake us up, right? To go, yeah, of course, this is the most important thing. We got to worry about our livelihoods, et cetera. But yeah, that we put that first. I think that is one of the lessons, that if we had that possibility, right, if our jobs allowed us to work remotely, which a lot of folks didn't. And I don't take that lightly that I was able to do that. It was amazing to get to be his son, and then to get, you know, to really nurture in some of those last days of his.
I was talking to a friend of mine, and we were talking about this work. You and I are in this work, to which, in order to do it, you have to do a lot of explaining to people about what you do and why you do it and why it's important. It's the number one frustration for me, that even before I get to what I want to do, I have to explain to you why what I'm getting ready to say to you is relevant. Introduce us to Equimundo and talk to us a little bit about why you created it and what it does.
Yeah, you know, Kenneth, I think that question is like, what's your elevator pitch for what Equimundo does? And sometimes I will start with a simplistic one that says, we've been helping men be nice since 1997. And really, at a simple level, that's it. How do we help men be our best connected, loving, caring selves? I started the work with colleagues in Brazil around violence against women. How do we bring men into that conversation? It's a challenging one. We got to talk about women are survivors of violence, what drives men to use it. But it was clear to us in all of that, that prevention requires visualizing what the better side is, what the best side is, and that men's care for ourselves, care for others, care for our children, care for others around us, is the antidote to some men's use of violence. And so really our work has always been around that kind of duality, work around preventing harm and violence, but promoting the good. And really the good, we think the one that shines the loudest, or the brightest, is around men's caregiving. So we started off, we do program work. We've designed father training materials, work with young men and with boys that are used in dozens of countries. We do advocacy work, and we have a couple of global campaigns on that. One is called the Global Boyhood Initiative, as it sounds, trying to promote healthy ideas about manhood, starting with boys. on our Men Care campaign that you mentioned before, that's now active in about 60 countries. And again, just trying to do sort of simple affirmational stuff that men can and want to be involved, that boys and young men can and want to be connected to better versions of manhood. You mentioned before a lot of the research. I put that in some in my bio. We use a lot of research to drive the conversations to try to get attention. Policymakers, funders, corporate sector, general public, that we're not just making this up because it feels good. We can show the benefits. We need it. We can show the gaps and call attention. And we can show how love and care pay forward. We can feel it, you know, so I think we talk a lot about being an organization that uses empathy to tell stories and uses evidence to show why it matters urgently now, and why we need, you know, everywhere from Congress to city councils to pay attention to this.
Yeah, I'm glad you used the word empathy, because I just wrote that down. And I think that one of the most important attributes for anyone doing this work around masculinity and fatherhood has to be that they must be an empathetic communicator. Because it's not so much what you say, it's how you say it. And you lead people to believe based on the assumptions that they bring to the table about what they think you do. Right. Or what they think you don't do. And so it's not just the ability to talk about manhood, to talk about masculinity, to talk about fatherhood, that you have to be able, you know, and one of the toughest subject matters to do that in is where I started as well, in the domestic violence space. 10 years ago, it was hard talking about fatherhood in those spaces. But I had to be a listener. I had to be empathetic, and I had to the extent possible, put myself not so much in their shoes, but at least in the pathway of their shoes, so that I can understand more acutely, you know, what the issues were. And then I had to figure out where my spaces were in that conversation and how I can show myself empathetic to the victims of domestic violence, but at the same time be able to explain and bring to the forefront the conversations that so often get suppressed because people can't communicate in an empathetic way to talk about things that should be considered when we're having this conversation overall. Do you still see in the spaces that you are having conversations around masculinity and fatherhood a difficulty in being able to bring an empathetic voice to the conversation?
Yeah, and I think, you know, we're seeing how much we've had an amazing social shift in this country that I think we can say, you know, Me Too is responsible for the years of advocates by women's rights leaders who have led the space of saying men's violence against women in the home and workplaces and schools is not okay. And I think, you know, we do have to honor and really respect and support how much that has reset a conversation for a lot of men and women. A lot of men were already on board with that even before these movements and have been allies in it. But it really has reset a conversation. I think the challenge is we've spent a lot of energy figuring out and getting better. We're still not as good as we need to be about calling out harm, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, we do. One of the things we've done is work with a lot of workplaces and corporations and others around how do you build systems where men are part of calling out harm that other men may carry out, whether that's at home or in the workplace. And those need to be, you know, made even better. But I think we often forget at the end of that, like, how do I call men in? If we're just calling out bad behavior all the time, we know it doesn't work in a third grade classroom, and it's not working with men in workplaces or in sports places or at home as well either, unless, and I think you hit the right language, like, what is it that is driving some men to cause harm to others and often to themselves as well? And I think we are, you know, that would be, I would say we live in that moment of tension of, we've got to acknowledge that the men who use harm against others are usually harmed individuals. They've witnessed violence growing up. They've experienced it. They have seen other men use violence. And in fact, rather than getting held accountable, get praise for it, perhaps get more power because of it. So this issue of this complex thing we call accountability, I think we've got to step into it with deep compassion. And so I think your watchword, your buzzword of empathy is right. We have to be able to do both at the same time. And that's, there's some days I can do that. And there's some days it's a hard one to say, wait, I got to care deeply about this man who's caused harm to somebody else. Mm-hmm. And I've got to convince you as a staff who's working with them to treat him with compassion while you're also calling him out. And I think, to step into how long-term it is to do restorative justice practice rather than our carceral approaches that are just, he caused harm, throw him out, lock him up. So yes, that's an ongoing one. But I actually do believe that, prevention can work, restorative processes work. We spend a lot of time evaluating those, and we can confirm that. If we're able to do it, but you know what this is like, Kenneth, like the way we get pressured by a funder, U.S. government, show us you can do this in 4 sessions.
Right.
And with more people all the time, as to say, look, this takes time, but we can do it. And that's it. It's stepping in with that combination of call you out for harm, call you in. We don't let you leave the room. You got to stay in here and acknowledge harm you may have caused, but in relation, not outside the room, not counting to 10 in the corner. You're with us. We can't let go.
Yeah, I've been able to. We have a client. Well, we have a potential partner that's coming on board now. And we sat a week or so ago and we laid out our curriculum and our philosophies and techniques and approaches and all those things. And they came back to us to do exactly what you just said. Well, we really don't want you to spend that much time with them. Can you do it in 2 weeks? And I'm like, well, yes, we could. But at the same time, you need to reduce your expectation by the same amount of time. And so if you cannot do that, then no, we cannot do this. And so it takes time. For transformation. It takes time for, I always tell folks that everybody deserves redemption. Everybody deserves redemption. And redemption doesn't come for each and every one of us in the same speed. And we have to be recognizable of that. The element that you bring to this work that I think is so intriguing, and I want to talk more about this as we move forward and continue to develop our relationships, Gary, so that I can figure out how do we bring what's happening in this space around the world to what it is happening here in the U.S. When you think about the work that you're doing internationally and the stuff that you're seeing out there, where are the nuances? Where are the things that are not so similar to what's happening in the U.S. that we can learn from that's taking place internationally?
Yeah. It's kind of easy to look, but important to look at what the, Western Europe, Scandinavia, but even parts of Latin America have done around making parental leave normal, an equal number of days for women, men, all caregivers, building that into workplaces. I think we're so focused on, productivity, work, and of course we need to work, and keeps our households thriving and alive. But watching how other countries have just like stepped into parental leave policies and saying, these are normal. Everybody's going to have some years of their work life. They need to have off to care for people in their households. And we can just make this normal. Mm-hmm. And sort of watching what that makes the streets look like of, more men pushing strollers, more folks talking to bosses where it's not like, oh yeah, you must not be a very serious worker if you're taking this time off. So I think one is just like to make that normality that, all of us are going to have some care duties. And just, making that kind of, it's not a big deal when dad's taken. And, because we know in the U.S., men are a lot less likely to take leave, even if they have access to it, which is, horrible reach in this country. The other, I think our important stuff to look at, which is, our fragmented health system. one of the ways that we've been able to achieve some national impact in a few countries is you've got a national health system, right? The only place we have that maybe in the U.S. is with our military, which has a single-payer system, works quite well, and they actually have some of the better fatherhood support policies in our country that we don't really talk much about. But it does matter when the health system and all the health providers are really part of this conversation with us. So that's when, you know, we've been able to use like a national prenatal protocol for men in Brazil that we helped develop, or in Rwanda, where I'm headed next week. We've set up a national fatherhood training program that's now been endorsed by the parliament in Rwanda, and it's going nationwide. You are having a child, you show up at the national health system, which is where most households go when they're for their prenatal care. You get invited into a 16-week parent training program that has 8 weeks of those sessions together with dads. We're doing that in a few other countries as well. And the nuance there you can do is a health system where everybody feeds into the same system at some point. So, you know, just the ability to like, it's a good thing if there's some ways that we connect up to the same services. I think those are a couple of ideas that I would put out there. You know, another one I would say is, how do we have conversations in schools about this?
Okay.
You know, I think if I think about my own trajectory as a father that I talked about at the beginning, right, there's sort of this idea that, you know, hey, baby comes out and we're already just, we know what to do to be parents, right? Our competency matters a huge amount. And I think thinking about ways like, how do we take these conversations to boys earlier on, that we get some hands-on experience in doing care work? And so how do we do that? You know, we've looked a lot at a program in Canada called Roots of Empathy that takes babies into the classroom and gets boys and girls thinking about, you know, what does that look like? How can we become attuned to the, you know, this magic that is a baby developing the ability to communicate, make eye contact, and begin to smile at you in the beginning of the back and forth dialogue that becomes, you know, how we become more human and more complex in our, how we communicate. Just watching 10-year-olds, I get to visit it in Toronto, and watching 10-year-olds just like, you know, and boys who usually don't think about this stuff just sort of come to life going, wow, look, baby Angela, she looked at me and she couldn't do that last time she was here and she likes me. And, you know, just watching a 10-year-old stop, you know, maybe bullying or trying to, you know, push the guy next to him to go, hey, I want baby Angela to smile at me. You know, so I think we need to think, you know, a bit more deeply in the U.S. about that. How do we have these conversations earlier on that we want our sons to learn how to be caregivers? And I've seen some interesting examples in other parts of the world.
Yeah, it's such a, you know, the work that we do, you know, if you take a moment to sit back and actually look at what we're trying to accomplish, it's such a beautiful and magical space, right, of work that we do when you see it activated, right? I am still, I don't care what I'm watching. It could be a drama series, a horror picture, a sports story, a documentary. If there's an element where there's a connect between fathers and children and it's a beautiful moment, I just start crying. It's just like, I don't know what it is about what God has placed in me, that those moments when I see them activate, they're extremely emotional for me and they keep me connected to that work to ensure that we create spaces and environments that those moments continue to happen. And I think that's why I dig in so deep, because it's, you really don't understand what you are placing an obstacle in front of. Like, we are placing obstacles in front of beautiful moments to which parents and families get to see a connection between men and their children outside of the dialogue that we create as it relates to them. And so folks of I Am Dad podcast, we really just chomping on the icing, you know, to get into the cake with Gary is going to take us 3 hours, which is why he's going to be coming back to talk more deeply about some of the pieces of work that he does. But before I go any deeper into that space, I want to take a peel back And talk about the reports, because it's so important that you document, analyze, and tell our story through a masculine lens. It's very important to do that. And that is one of the things that I admire about Equimundo: A, the national, the international perspective, B, the masculine perspective, but C, this whole notion that we have to document and put it on paper, because if we don't, it doesn't exist. And so you did two this year. One was focused specifically on American men. And then the second that I was able to kind of celebrate with you in Washington, D.C. and in L.A. and hopefully moving forward, continuing to move the outcomes of both of those reports out into the U.S. space through our mechanisms, not just through Fathers Incorporated, but through our contract with the National Responsible Fatherhood Clearinghouse, to see how we can really uplift this conversation and move it deeper into the space of social service. Let's start with the men's report, because I was intrigued by some of the outcomes in the men's report. Can you talk about that and some of the things that stood out to you in that report?
Yeah, I mean, we kind of knew some of the things that were coming, which is lots of young men, particularly in this country, are confused of, you know, what do we mean by manhood these days? And back to that point I made, that we've done a lot of calling out the harm of we spent a couple of years repeating that not very useful phrase of toxic masculinity, but we didn't fill in, okay, what's the other side of this, right? We created a lot of uncertainty in young men of, what does it mean to be a good, connected, caring, dignified man? And I think what we found in our survey is a lot of guys are lost and disconnected. Very high percentages say nobody knows me. 2/3 said nobody knows me. In this moment of confusion, nearly half are finding some voice online who's usually spouting some negative view about manhood, often mixed with giving you some life examples of like how to be better and sit up straight and how much water to drink and what kind of exercise routine to do. All things that can be quite positive, but usually mixed with a, hey, don't listen to any of that women's rights stuff. Don't listen to any of the, you know, the LGBTI plus stuff. Don't worry about any of that racial justice stuff. Just, you know, go get your own and take care of yourself. So there's a lot of negative conversation happening online. Nobody who's a parent or hangs out with young men will be surprised about that. How much economic insecurity is driving men's anger? And a lot of men thinking, well, you know, I'm not really sure where I'm going to get my next paycheck. So why should I worry about women? Or why should I worry about immigrants? Or if I'm a white person, why should I worry about a person of color if I'm not sure where mine is coming from? So we affirmed in our data how much that is true. And very worryingly, we affirmed that the more guys believed in a restrictive, what we call the man box version of manhood, and lots of others using that expression as well, the more likely we are to believe we got purpose in life. And that's scary, because it tells us how those of us who believe there's a healthier, better connected version of manhood, and there's lots of us who believe that. I don't mean to say we're the only ones, and there's a lot of guys believing already those versions, but we got to do a huge amount of marketing, promotion, conversation, relation, you know, relating to make the case, you know, of what a healthy, compassionate, wholehearted version of manhood is that isn't about harming others or putting myself against others. So that was troubling. And I'm glad you could be with us there, Kenneth, at that conversation, because I think your work and our collective work around fatherhood just tells us how much care and men's ability to care for others seems to me and seems to us so much part of that antidote, that we got to stop just calling the harm out and really say, you know, the muscle we need men to work on between some hours in the gym is, you know, is the middle of their chest here, and it's called our heart, and it's how we connect to others. That's really... And if men do that, you know, that's another piece of the data. The more men do that, the more they're, you know, they're happier, they're healthier. The other stuff just kind of, it goes away. So that would be the headline that I'd take. You know, the antidote to the harm that we're seeing in the confusion is helping men embrace caring versions of manhood.
Yeah, you know, it's, you know, when you see that play itself out in society, you know, and it's interesting, because I don't know, and I'm sure you see this. It's amazing when my work shows up in my friendships and my relationship, right? And so when I hear people who are close to me, my family members and my friends and the parents on my team, on my son's AAU team and the teachers and people, and you hear men kind of talk and you can hear things come out of their mouths and you're like, wow, that's like really like highlighting the piece of work that I'm doing. And this stuff is real. I used to say to people when I first started this work, one of the things that I did was I worked, my fatherhood program was within the New York State Child Support Enforcement Agency. And so when I ran fatherhood for the state of New York, I got to run it within child support. So I got to really be inside what was described and what many fathers describe as the belly of the beast, right? And so to really see, you know, what this looked like on the inside, to begin to kind of see the inner working so that I could be able to your point earlier, be empathetic about the work itself, but also be empathetic about the people that it is impacting, primarily dads. But one of the things I used to say, Gary, because I used to go home and I used to always say to myself that I do this work at a very high level in the state of New York around really looking how to stabilize and give more healthy influences to relationships so that both moms and dads can be better parents and we can create a higher level of healthy child well-being. That if my work isn't hitting my neighbor, my work is not effective. Like, why? Yeah. How is it if I'm doing this work at that level and I don't see it hitting my neighbor, then I'm doing something wrong? And I carry that with me today, even at the national level. When I go around the country and I hear fathers talk about X, or I hear moms talk about X, or I hear children who have had some level of father absence in their life talk about X, I wonder why my work and why our collective work from the very top is not permeating all the way down to the individuals that we're trying to serve. And maybe we just got to do more. Maybe we got to do something different. I don't know what it is sometimes, but do you think about how your work is being impacted by the normal everyday family?
Yeah. And I'll tell one success story and then I'll tell the challenging story as well. It's like, one of the most exciting things I got to do I started in Brazil. And my family, we moved here, the exact month that Obama, entered the White House. that wasn't by chance. I lived in Latin America during many, conservative administrations, sometimes on purpose and sometimes just by luck of where I ended up being. But we were in Chicago when Obama was making the, beginning of his career. Then we're, watching what's happening, going, man, we want to be in the U.S. for this. This is a moment to be in the U.S. And so we started Promundo, and now Equimundo, when we changed its name. We mostly doing international work, but I got invited by a city council member here in D.C. I knew his wife, and they were actually going to travel to Brazil. He wanted to visit the work in Brazil. And he came back, he said, man, I got to do something about fatherhood. I want to think what we can do. I had a chance to see your work in Brazil. This is really interesting stuff. And one of the things we started to talk about was parental leave and say, man, we need leave. We got nothing. What can you do in D.C.? And that obviously was part of many others. That was only one small part of lots of folks like Vicky Shabo and New America Foundation and the folks at the National Partnership on Women and Families that you probably know as well. Lots of other voices pushing on it. But I got asked to testify around DC paid leave and provide some language that went into the bill that got passed. And a year later, I've had people on staff and folks like Rodrigo Stein, who was with us, with the second gentleman there, who was taking leave, of like folks I know who are getting paid leave in the District of Columbia. Because we had a voice in that conversation. I think we're kind of desperate about not having the U.S. national policies we'd want. But I think there are moments of going, okay, this advocacy pays, it pays forward. Information made a difference. We could tell the stories. We could show the data. Some folks listened. They voted in the right direction. I contrast that with You know, if I look in the neighborhood I live in DC, of how we're also just the same, you know, the challenges about young men who aren't perceiving pathways forward, feeling like, you know, the system around them and DC police, although I think they're a lot better than in a lot of cities, just how much the first response from our responders in the city can often be of on young men of color. And so if I think of the neighborhood that I live in, that's quite mixed in DC, of feeling like, and having watched and talked to a couple of young men of their encounters with DC police versus mine, mm-hmm. You know, of I'm seen as the homeowner, they're seen as the threat, you know, and just, so I feel, you know, I suppose if you say what causes me the deepest anguish in the country is, you know, still around that, like we have not stepped around creating enough opportunities, particularly for young men of color in this country, and how our legal system treats, and you see this later on when what the legal system does in our country of separating, because most of our young, you know, most young men in prison are a father someplace, as you know better than we do. So yeah, that's where I feel like, man, this feels like, you know, the impact is still far, far away.
And that's also why I stay so adamant about being in these spaces and being connected to the work that you're doing and others are doing, just so that voice is always in the room, you know, as we're having these conversations. It was a crazy, I had this moment when we were at Capitol, and I'll talk about the DAG caucus, and I want you to talk about that in a second. But I remember, man, the couple of days before that, I was just so anxious. I didn't want to fumble my words, and I never do. I speak from my heart when I step into the space, but I wrote down like what I wanted to say, and I don't do that. That is not what I do. I don't write my thoughts down. I wait till I get to the room and I let them spill out. Yeah. And I'm listening to all this conversation that day, and I'm hearing, and I'm like, no, Kenny, stick to the script, stick to the script, stick to the script. And I'm listening to everybody talking, and I stuck to the script, and I was so upset at myself because nothing I wanted to say, I said. Nothing I wanted to say in that room, I said. And it was so frustrating because it was me, A, trying not to let you down, trying not to let my invitation into the room down by pouring out from my heart what I thought needed to be heard, outside of being able to talk about the young lady that passed away from the infant death. And so yeah, just putting her room, her name into the space, because it was so relevant to the black mortality rate stuff that we're talking about, but didn't get a chance to like take all of these voices that were in my head from these fathers around the country that are struggling through policies to be able to be in the lives of their children, and they're not able to do so. And I said, I will never, ever do that again. You know, when I'm in the room.
Well, Kenneth, if I can say, if somebody who's now, I guess, seen you speak three times, if you came across, if you consider that a bad day, you come across, your humanity, your heart, your passion came across. And so what I felt, you gave me permission to, like, I threw my text away. So maybe what you came, I then stepped into, you know, a story about my daughter and some of the stuff you asked me at the beginning of this. So if you thought that was scripted, man, your heart came through. So
yeah,
I would pick yourself up about that, please.
Yeah, no. So it really is important, you know, that this conversation, particularly around, which is why my work in the U.S. is so focused on black fathers. Yeah. Because it comes in front of my own experience as a dad, and you know, 98% of the people that I'm surrounded by. So I see the nuance and how it actually impacts them. And then through my work through the National Responsible Father Clearinghouse, I get to see it on a national level. So I know what it looks like in rural America, urban America, the East Coast, the West Coast, the Southwest Coast, the Northeast Coast. I know what it looks like in the tribal region. I know what it looks like everywhere. And it's what makes me more acutely aware of how things are impacting men of color around the country. And now women of color, but I do want you to talk a little bit about your thoughts about the Dad's Caucus, because I think it's until you brought it up, I had never heard about it. I never knew that existed. And so it's such a critical thing for me to know, if not only to inform it by my personal work in this space, but by the work of the federal government, particularly HHS, that's actually doing a pretty good job in funding grantees around the country to tackle this work around the country, that can inform the Dad Caucus on the policies and things that are necessary from the federal government to strengthen their ability to impact more families. So thank you, if for nothing else, putting me in that pathway. So now I can connect them with some of the real work that's being done around that allows them to be able to take forward proof of concept and workable solutions that are being researched and evidence-based out there that they can then support to get what you and I have been talking about for the last decades, right? So
we were thrilled to, well, I know you're going to have the congressman on, of Congressman Gomez. We were thrilled to hear about, you know, how they sprung up the beginning of this term, right? This new Congress. And I think, you know, we've had allies before. We have certainly leaned, you know, to other folks who do the kind of advocacy on the Hill, to like, who in Congress, who on the Senate is interested in this topic. We've always had allies on this topic. But I think what's different about the Dad's Caucus, to me, getting a chance to meet some of them, is how much they are starting to talk about, in the same way you started this off, they're talking about being dads first, and then they talk about being congressmen who have policies to promote. And I think it means they're centering the policies the way they need to be. They're not standing up there just talking about, you know, House Bill 748. They are saying, I need this. My constituents need this. I got stake in this. You know, I got skin in this game. They're telling stories. They're doing the empathy stuff. They're bringing their babies, power to them, and their small children to it. They're bringing their partners. And I really, it's the obvious thing. And I, you know, Congressman Gomez doesn't, you know, he would be the first one to say, don't give him extra praise for it. But I really like that he centered saying, women have been talking about this forever. It's time that men do this together with them, not instead of them. And I think with that, you know, he had it off on the right foot. And I think that's been so important for us as well. And I think the other is to say, you know, in our data, you talk to our other reports, State of American Fathers, it kind of affirmed the obvious, which is that men care deeply about this. We acknowledge that we get to be better humans when we do it. We're happier when we get to be the involved caregivers that we want to. If you don't believe that from your heart, we can show you the data that is, you know, that's valid and it holds up, but it is just, it's so obvious. And the other part that we held up, and you heard me bring that up with the second gentleman, is that men want this. They want the whole, you know, the whole policy array that the Dad's Caucus is about is, we want leave policies, right? Paid leave, guaranteed, national. We want childcare. Households need it. Dads are ready to vote for it. And the child tax credit, right? The basic stuff of, we got to pay attention to poverty, and particularly households of color, and all households of, you know, facing poverty. That, you know, and the other part that's pretty clear that I hope, and I think, you know, Congressman Gomez and his staff got, is this stuff turns into votes.
Yes.
Like, make it known that you vote on this. This is how you vote, and go to your constituents and tell them, this is how you want to vote. And the majority in the country actually believe in it. We just got to get past, you know, the kind of the hate mongers and the fear mongers. So that's where I'm really excited, because I think they've just like connected their personal stories with the policies that we all need.
Yeah, I'm glad you came back to the report. You and I are going to have to come back and talk specifically and about nothing else but the report, because there's so
much. This is much more fun to tell these stories from the heart than the report stuff.
There's so much meat in that report that I don't want to not allow people to kind of understand it. We're going to share it. We're going to talk about it. But I really want to bring you back at some point to really just talk specifically about that report, because I think it is relevant in the conversation. You know, one of the things that, you know, and I'll talk to the congressman, you know, when I interview him, just in terms of just sharing my thoughts about what I'm seeing and hearing. And I've been kind of telling people about that meeting since we've done it, just kind of telling them about the conversation and the excitement in the room around the conversation around dads and the people who were in the room, and that many of them I'm going to try to get on my podcast to kind of talk about their own work in these spaces. But one of the things that stood out to me as I was telling these stories about the paid leave, and then about the income tax credit, and then about the black mortality rate amongst mortality rate amongst black women, is that what I heard a lot about how we are seeking support for dads on those issues. But I heard very little, if anything, about how we are going to directly support dads. And I was like, there has to be a leveling of that conversation, because to your point earlier, you are not going to get dads to wholeheartedly. They're going to be empathetic about the issue. But until you can equally speak to them about how you're going to help them struggle in their own day-to-day issues, it's going to be very difficult for them to listen with respect to how and why they should support these things actively. And yeah. So I just want to make sure that, you know, for folks like you and myself and the other organizations and groups that are in our circle, that we continue to press that as an issue as they continue to elevate their voices in this space, that let's be clear that, you know, I'm on team all of that stuff. I'm on your team. I'm ready to rah, 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 rah. But I got dads that are hurting, and I got dads yeah. that are in need, and I got dads that need resources, and I got dads that need a hug. I got dads that need a place yeah. to stay. I got dads that need information and resources. And in order to get them on board, you're going to have to give up something for them. And that's what's going to get you to the point that you just talked about, which is that's when they're going to start to pay attention to their vote when they walk into the booth. Who is helping me in my own spaces, right?
Yeah.
So I don't know how we have that kind of, but that was what I took away walking away. And I was like, oh, now I know my charge. My charge is to make sure that these fathers out here that need support, their voices are not forgotten in this conversation, and the need for us to stand up, you know, for the women in our lives, the moms in our lives, and the wives and children in our lives that also need resources and desperately need attention to some of the things that are not working for them so well. And so, yeah, some of that and all of that.
Yeah, agreed. You know, I think you're right in terms of Kenneth, the work that you do supported by the federal government is kind of the place where we've in this country placed fatherhood work instead of looking across all the places where we need to look at where fathers should be there, from the violence prevention work to our early childhood work to Head Start. And I know there is important stuff happening in all those places, but it ends up too often just being kind of piecemeal. We think of it at the very end. And our social welfare policies in the U.S., as thin and fragile and incomplete as they are, they continue to look at, if there's a dad around, we don't need to help you because he's only around for income, right? We continue to look at dads of if he's a provider or he's nothing. It's kind of mostly what we care about in most of our national policies. So, yeah, I think the need for and maybe we should take advantage of the fact we've got some allies at the moment and say, what's a national fatherhood policy look like that goes beyond the important stuff that's already being funded to breaking out of the silos? Because otherwise it just continues to be this kind of piecemeal. We think of it too late. I suppose, Kenneth, I think probably we're probably in a field of work that if we're successful and people listen to us, we won't need to harp on this all the time.
Absolutely.
Putting ourselves out of the job. But I think that's it. It's like, I shouldn't have to be thinking about this by myself or with a handful of allies here. You should be doing it. Take my job.
Right.
Absolutely. Build it into yours.
Yeah. I could be doing so many other things. I could be traveling to Africa and helping, you know, children and families in other countries and really doing that level of work.
Yeah. God,
thanks so much. This has been incredible. Do you have any lasting words? Anything you want people to know?
You know, I think I just want, you know, I think we're so often looks like, oh, it's so hard to get dads involved. It's so hard to, you know, we learn around the world. Some folks will say, oh, those countries must be really tough to work on it, or that community in the U.S. This is the easiest conversation to have with men, mm-hmm. is letting them be the caring humans that we want to be. So I suppose, you know, if I take from the international work, it's just that this is such a universal language around men want to be, we can be, we get better when we, you know, practice care and love. Our children benefit from it. Our partners benefit from it. You know, societies get better from it. I just can't understand why people don't get it.
Well, I've been using this word lately, probably over the last 6 months, if not a little more. And I've been talking about how we need to figure out how to humanize our work.
Yeah.
Like, that's where we need to get. We need to get people to have a level of humanity for men. Right? Yeah. It's not necessity to do something. It's not desire of an outcome. It is that you should care about them because of the humanity within yourself.
Yeah.
And so that is the language that I'm seeking in my dialogue, to see if I can encourage more people to start with a level of humanity when I say responsible fatherhood, as opposed to objectively around their own personal needs or thoughts or stereotypes or those kinds of things. The other thing, and I'm going to throw this out real quick and we'll come back and talk about this, because I think in my mind, at least, it is a emerging conversation. At least it hits me in my head whenever I hear the word caretaker. And what I've been thinking about is, how do we support men who are caretakers of their parents?
Yeah.
Right. When we think about caretakers, we always think about it the back way. We think about them being caretakers of their children. But more and more, my friends, particularly men, husbands, are beginning now to be responsible, solely responsible for taking care of their parents, right, in this space, from all kinds of things, from dementia to you name it. They poverty, don't have enough in the healthcare system or retirement system to put them where they need to get the services. And as a result, not only are men struggling, but families are struggling, right, in this space. And we're not talking enough about what that looks like, you know, for men who are now charged with, even in the unfortunate case where they were not responsible for taking care of their children, now they're responsible for taking care of their parents. And I always say, if you want one big motivator for taking care of your children, that is when you get too so old, you have someone to take care of you. If you want to be selfish.
And them seeing, and them seeing you care for your parents.
Right.
Right. You also set that in place by them seeing, oh, it's not like he wants me to care for him, but he didn't care for his parents.
Right.
I think we also set it in place by that model that we live of, are they seeing us do that? And that feels to me like in the fatherhood space and the men in care space, like pretty neglected. And yet it's about a quarter of our households now. Mm-hmm. We've got care for elderly family members. Men are doing a lot of it. But I think a lot like, you know, caring for young children, like we need practice. We need to talk about it. It's heavy. It's tiring. It's rewarding. All those things at the same time. And so I think opening up some spaces for men to talk about that, I think, and how it's a dual muscle, right? It's like I care for Ai Jin Poo says we're not the sandwich generation. We're the panini generation because we're squished, you know, with having to care for young kids and for our elderly parents. Mm. And I think just like helping men talk about that, empowering men to do, you know, to do it, making some space where we talk about it. So Kenneth, talk about it. I think you're gonna, a lot of men want to have something to say about that.
Right. Well, we're going to end now for real. And so we're going to come back. Thank you again, Gary, for showing up when I called. I appreciate everything about you. I appreciate everything about what you're doing. And I am 1,000% in all of the work that you're doing. And all you guys got to do is pick up the phone. If I'm available, I'm there. Because I think what you're doing is so critical to the work that we're doing, and also to the continuing stabilization of the foundation of the things that we have to do and create so that this work can continue to move forward. And so to my I Am That podcast listeners, you know, my wife has now forced me to do what I don't like to do, and that is to tell you what I need you to do, right? Which is, if you're watching this on YouTube, I need you to look down there at that subscribe button, and I need you to hit it. If you are listening to this on any of your social media platforms and you see that subscribe button, please hit that button, because it is important to our algorithm. It is important to our analytics, and it is important to the folks that I have as guests to help them understand that our reach is pretty significant. And we just found out literally a few days ago that, according to FeedSpot, which is a international analytic of podcasts and social media, broken down into genres of podcasts, that out of 1,700, a little over 1,700 dad podcasts around the world, that I Am Dad is number 7. And so I am very proud of that. I was excited and stunned when I saw it, and when I got the email from them and looked at the list and saw that we were number 7 amongst 1,700 fatherhood podcasts around the world, really puts a burden on my shoulder to recognize what it is we've established and to continue to use this platform to elevate the voices around the world that are speaking to this particular subject matter. So I do know that amongst the 6 above me, that they're not in the space that I'm in, which is really talking about the field and the work of responsible fatherhood and manhood. They're doing other things that are more popular that people want to talk about, and that's okay too. But when it comes to really elevating this professional side of the work and what it is that's taking place, not only around the U.S., but around the world, we still want to be a champion and a leader in that space. And so in order for that to happen for us, I need you to hit that subscribe button. And I'll be watching over the next couple of weeks, because what I see in my analytics, and YouTube is really good on telling me what's happening. Right now, amongst all of our listeners, only 98% of the people who listen and watch on YouTube are actual subscribers. So that means you guys are watching my content and then you're walking away, but you're not leaving anything for me. And so I need that to happen for me and to see that percentage number go up. In the meantime, in between time, thank you so much for listening to I Am Dad Podcast. For all previous episodes, go to IamDadPodcast.com. Make sure you look up Equimundo. All of their information will be on our website to download the 2 reports on America's men as well as fathers in this country. They are great reads. I want you to give feedback to them through their feedback mechanisms. Follow them on Twitter. Follow them on all their spaces. And those links will be in our bio, in our link in our bio as well, once this show airs. And until next Sunday, thank you so much. God bless. And I'll see you next time. Peace out.
Thank you so much for taking the time to spend with us. You've been listening to I Am Dad Podcast. We hope that you have been informed, encouraged you to think, or even inspired your heart for the love of dads. The conversation does not end here. Come back and join us next week. Same time, same place. Or you can continue the dialogue on our I Am Dad Facebook page. We also invite you to listen to past episodes, learn more about us, and keep up with special activities by visiting IamDadPodcast.com. That's IamDadPodcast.com. Until next time, I leave you with this reminder of manhood from 1 Corinthians chapter 13, verse 11. When I was a child, I spoke as a child. I understood as a child. I thought as a child. But when I became a man, I put away childish things. Because of this reminder, I will always understand that I am dad, period.